from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today we observe the National Day of Prayer and Remembrance for the victims of Katrina. We'll hear from historian Douglas Brinkley, who teaches at Tulane University in New Orleans and has already started to write the history of the hurricane. Then we'll talk with one of the people he considers a hero for having rescued so many people, Reverend Willie Walker, pastor of Noah's Ark Church. We'll talk with a cop who rescued prison inmates and a priest who was rescued and taken to the Superdome. Alice Siebold will reflect on remembering the dead, and trumpeter Gregory Davis of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band will talk about playing for jazz funerals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we observe the National Day of Prayer and Remembrance for the victims of Katrina. We'll hear from rescuers, survivors, and a musician who's played hundreds of New Orleans funerals. Each of these people has been changed by what they experienced during and after the hurricane. Our first guest, the historian Douglas Brinkley, is already at work documenting Katrina. His book, tentatively titled The Great Deluge, is scheduled to be published early next year. Brinkley is a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans. He's created a Tulane University task force to document the catastrophe through oral histories. He's the author of the bestsellers Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War, and The Boys of Pointe du Hoc, Ronald Reagan, D-Day, and the U.S. Army 2nd Ranger Battalion. I asked Brinkley why he's already writing a history of Katrina.
And I'm very determined to make sure, as a historian and somebody who loves New Orleans, it's my home, I teach at Tulane University, that we don't forget what happened, that we learn why this is not just a catastrophe, but it's a deluge, and that I want to make sure that we get the oral history testimonies, talk to as many evacuees as possible, talk to as many state, local, federal officials, try to get to the bottom of it. And while the media has been, I think, very good and are generating daily great stories, I want to use all of those as primary source material, but also develop my own oral history project where over a period of a couple years, I plan to get the voices of 2,000, 3,000 additional people just for my own Tulane project.
So what's the process you're putting into effect to get the history of what happened?
Well, the first thing is to communicate, which is what didn't happen. I was in New Orleans for Katrina, and then got out of town afterwards, and I came back, and I was constantly encountered people on dry land, mainly FEMA people, trying to stop rescue attempts of people that were desperate for help, and that startled me that this could happen in our country. I understand politics, and I understand that sometimes we can debate something like the war in Iraq, but this seems so basic. People are flooded. They're screaming for help. Get a boat and go get them. Yet people that had the means to save a lot of people weren't doing it. And I recognized at that point that something Dwight Eisenhower had said when he was general after World War II and encountered the concentration camps in Europe. And he said, immediately, I want it completely documented by photograph, film, interviews, everything, because if our government can turn their backs at these people in need, they will try to whitewash what happened and make it seem like it was God's storm and there was not that much that could have been done. And I think it's the story's much bigger than that.
You say you saw FEMA representatives preventing people from rescuing people?
Yes. First off, they would stop trucks in Baton Rouge that they didn't have on their clipboard. And if you were a private sector truck trying to bring in supplies, you were just completely derailed. Secondly, in New Orleans at St. Charles near Manali's restaurant, there were groups of federal officials who didn't want to get a wrinkle in their clothes, who stood by when virtually people, including schizophrenics, people with diabetes, elderly people with arthritis, were having to be saved by common citizens in fishing boats who would bring them to dry land. We'd put them on the shore, and then the government officials would just let them sit there, and they'd tell you, well, we're going to get them to a hospital. I didn't trust them, and so I would circle back, and 4 or 5 hours later, these people that were in desperate pain with nothing, still sitting on a street curb after they were pulled out of the water, nobody there to help them, yet they're surrounded by a sea of government officials. You know, part of it seemed to be a resentment that these people had stayed in New Orleans. The feeling was you had a warning to get out. Why did 100,000 of you stay?
Why did you decide to become like a freelance rescuer during a hurricane?
It was not for, I came back to Houston, set my family up in an apartment, and you start watching on television, listening to radio, and you start thinking, my gosh, this is my city, and I'm just kind of sitting here in some air-conditioned, high-rise Houston hotel, and there must be something I can do. And so I went back and just wanted to connect with some friends I knew, and I had a lot of addresses of people to go check on. Somebody who was missing a mother who had Alzheimer's, who was in this apartment and it was flooded. And I did some of that. Then I met a fellow named Reverend Willie Walker, who has a Noah's Ark church. And he told me that there were loads of children trapped in a building, and he needed a boat. And with a couple friends of mine, we went and found a kind of primitive but useful fishing boat and went out. And sure enough, we just started pulling people in. Many of the people that stayed that I encountered in this, and you know, you'd have to take the boat in this thick, toxic muck we keep hearing about, and you'd get there. Many of them stayed because they were too ill to go. They were living on pension checks. They couldn't leave their apartment. They were elderly and by themselves. Some had mental disabilities and weren't really loved by anybody and were kind of the leftovers. There were some people with a drug addiction problem, AIDS people we encountered. It was a group of the downtrodden, if you'd like, or what Michael Harrington, you know, would call the other America, the kind of people we don't see a lot or hear a lot about. But they were there in mass, hadn't left, and were frightened to death. And so we did the best we could to start bringing them back. It would have been a normal reaction for anybody that was there on the spot because, you know, it wasn't a time to think about your own safety or what. You just knew that people were in dire straits, so you kind of just lended a hand.
What are you mourning most about the city now? What are you afraid you're going to miss most? Afraid that will never be the same about the city?
Well, the good news is the French Quarter, Warehouse District, Garden District, and Uptown is going to survive. They didn't get too much of the flooding damage. You're going to fix some windows, clear some trees, get electricity and water running. And the historic New Orleans will be back in business. But it's these side neighborhoods and communities, the near where the levees broke along Lake Pontchartrain, that I just believe are going to be devastated. Any wooden house, which was part of the charm of New Orleans, were these great wooden shotgun homes and these kind of ramshackle Victorians. And they've all been devastated. They're going to be bulldozed down. And I kind of will miss that, seeing those neighborhoods, because I'm afraid what will come in are these prefab townhouses. And it'll kind of start looking like suburbia instead of this kind of rich subtropical Afro-Caribbean center, which I love so much.
How long have you lived in New Orleans?
I've been there now since 1992. So I, and it's been it's my adopted home. My wife's born and raised there, and her family is. And so now I'm an expat in Houston, and my whole wife's family's with us. But I first fell in love with New Orleans because of the folklore of it. You'd hear stories about it. And as a historian, I was always very interested in the lore of the Mississippi and New Orleans. And when I first went there as a boy with my mother and father, I just was just taken with it, as some people are. So for me, it's my Paris and London and Venice and Amsterdam all rolled into one. And that's so much, I'm somebody who loves poetry and literature. And I mean, anywhere you walk there, it's where John Dos Passos wrote Manhattan Transfer. Walt Whitman worked there here at this location as a editor. Or this is where Tennessee Williams wrote Streetcar Named Desire. And Truman Capote was born here. And this is the house William Faulkner wrote his first book. And it goes on and on. And yet it's not a plaqued city. It's not. There's so much literary and musical history that kind of gets forgotten. You can walk to these historic sites in other cities. There'd be a big marker there. But in New Orleans, it's just kind of part of the Big Easy history life. And that's always fascinated me a great deal. It's still, to me, due to the music and the culture and the food, I mean, it's just a magical kind of place. To think of America without it gives me a kind of a vision of a homogenized America.
You know, having gone through the hurricane, having gone back to help rescue people, and now starting a history project documenting what happened, I'm wondering how all of that has affected your sense of identity as an American, your sense of being part of a city, a state, and a country.
I'm very disappointed in my country. You know, I write American history for a living. I love America, and as a boy, I spent my summers. My parents were teachers, and we had a trailer, and we traveled the country, and I live for this country. I mean, I am a great patriot, but I feel that our government, particularly the federal government, but also the state government in Louisiana, let us down. Don't want to see that happen. When you love your country, you have to raise your voice in dissent when you see something wrong. But what surprised me about myself is what an identity I have to New Orleans. I've been living there. I first taught at University of New Orleans, now Tulane University. It's where my life revolves around. But I realized just how many friends I have there, and like we're all here together. And normally when I hear of a hurricane, I'd say, get out. Like I leave, you know, I can go other places. I know people. I can move to California or New York. And I'm haunted. I'm kind of like driven back to New Orleans. And I realized that's what home is. It's a place you love so much. And your attachments are so deeply rooted to the landscape in a way that it's not for some people a simple matter of being pragmatic and going elsewhere.
As you begin work on your project documenting Hurricane Katrina, is there a historical incident of the past that you've been thinking about a lot?
Well, like a lot of people, we're suddenly doing quick history lessons on things like the Galveston hurricane of 1900, which killed over 8,000 people. But the Galveston's interesting because what got rebuilt was Houston out of it. And Galveston stayed a port city. It's a historic city. People live there. But the industrial thrust of the commerce moved to Houston a little bit from the Gulf of Mexico. And I think you might see that with New Orleans, where Baton Rouge, which was 250,000 people, is now about 500. It's the biggest city overnight. But also things like the San Francisco earthquake or the Great Chicago Fire, the Johnstown flood, it does make you and make journalists look back at some of those and realize that communities can spring back. I would argue San Francisco is probably the most beautiful and efficient cityscape in America today. And it certainly wasn't that after the earthquake when you look at the photographs and hear the stories. So I think the history in this way reminds us that our times are not uniquely oppressive. And that as bad as it seems in New Orleans and the Gulf region, we can spring back and will spring back. And history is a good guide for that.
So you were in New Orleans throughout the whole hurricane?
Yes, I was. I did a vertical evacuation to the 15th floor of a building known as One River Place. The reason we did that was my father-in-law was the architect of the building, and it was built after Hurricane Camille in 1969. So it was supposedly a hurricane-proof building. And I do have to say it did survive in very good shape, except I was on the top floor and some of the balconies started blowing off. The generator that was supposed to be there for the building didn't work, so we had to sit in the lobby with a lot of other people that stayed. But I was very blessed that this building was along the river and not along Lake Pontchartrain, and that it was very well designed architecturally to survive a storm of this magnitude. Very few buildings in New Orleans are.
Well, while you were in New Orleans during the hurricane in this high-rise that you had evacuated to, what is the most amazing part of the hurricane that you witnessed?
Well, there's, you know, I'm a great lover of the Mississippi River, and Mark Twain once said, you know, no sense ever studying the river because it changes its course every week, meaning it's a hard river to map. Of course, the Army Corps of Engineers, after the Great Flood of 1927, has built up the levee system. But sitting on top of on the balcony of a high rise right on the river, I saw the Mississippi run backwards. I never thought I'd live to see such a thing. The wrath of the storm was white capping the river, and all that water from the Gulf was flowing up river instead of down. And so it was a menacing, horrific sight, which is etched in my memory forever. And it was, it's hard to believe a river as large and powerful and potent as the Mississippi could turn on its heels and run backwards. But that's what it did.
Doug Brinkley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Terry.
Douglas Brinkley is a professor of history at Tulane University and is writing a book about Katrina, scheduled for publication early next year. Coming up, we talk with one of the people Brinkley thinks emerged from the storm as a hero, Reverend Willie Walker. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Reverend Willie Walker, is one of the people historian Douglas Brinkley says emerged as a hero during the hurricane. Reverend Walker is the pastor of Noah's Ark Ministries in New Orleans. His neighborhood was flooded, his church badly damaged. After helping his family evacuate, he went back into the city to rescue people by boat. At what point did you decide to personally organize a rescue effort?
It was, I guess, that Tuesday, after I made sure my immediate family were out of the city. I noticed that the waters just kept rising and they weren't going down. And I just went back into the city and said, look, I'm here to help with rescue. I got tired of just these feeble reports about not enough people. Everything is uncoordinated. I see people on roofs hollering and screaming. And I was getting stories that people were drowning in their houses, medication not available, dialysis machines going out, air running out on people. And I just took it upon myself to go. And we just started taking people off of second-story roofs, second-story balconies. And we were just loading them up, and we were just bringing them back to the two-lane overpass. And we were just, I was just giving them instructions to tell them that, hey, tell them Pastor Walker dropped you off, and he's going back to get more people.
What neighborhood is your church in? Would you describe the neighborhood for us?
I'm in Central City. And that neighborhood is, it's really poverty-ridden. It's hardcore neglect from, I guess, years of abandonment houses and a lot of drug deals, crooked cops at one time. But God has really blessed through Noah's Ark Ministries. And we've cleaned up a lot of the areas that were just dilapidated and torn down and we've actually stopped a lot of the violence and the dope dealing that was going on.
Most of the people who were in New Orleans during the hurricane, most of the people in the Superdome, most of the people evacuated to the Astrodome were African American. And, you know, looking back on the past couple of weeks, what does how the storm played out and how it was handled, what does it say to you about race?
It definitely is still a problem in America. It's one that we address, it seems like, only in crucial situations. And I made a statement that America's dress has been raised and her panties are dirty. We're trying to force the world to accept our culture, but we're not living up to the standards that we want the rest of the world to embrace.
In extreme times, some people find their faith is shaken. And they lose their faith, and other people find their faith is strengthened or find faith who never had faith before. And I'm wondering how do you feel like your faith was tested in any way?
Our faith is tested every day. You know, and my thing is I don't look at situations and conditions because they change. Happenstances and things we go through, they change. The Bible says, if I look past the hills towards my help, the hills which cometh my help, all of my help coming from the Lord, things are going to be just like God said they were going to be. There's going to be perilous times. There's going to be trouble in the land. And here it is. I can't be shaken by the things that I see. Through faith, I'm walking this race. And yes, God strengthened me to deal with the dead folk around me, to comfort the people with the horror stories, homes being broken in, being threatened by people. You know, God just, I was just made for this time. I consider myself an end-time preacher, a radical preacher, ready to go to another level because it seems as though we've become complacent in America.
Today is a national day of prayer and remembrance. Is there a particular prayer that you'll be saying today?
Well, I have a prayer that I really say every day for all of mankind, and that's the 23rd Psalm, that we would embrace it and really use our God, Jehovah, as our Father, and we would heed to His word and be obedient, turn back to a way of holiness and respect and reverence. And we've become complacent. We we become spoiled and we become a bunch of people who are in a microwave society. And if it doesn't come when we want it, we'll do what we have to do to get it. And, you know, I'm just reflecting back. You know, the Lord said in first he took it by water, next time by fire. This is a flashback to biblical days. The water splashed, the people were scattered, some were lost. But next time, will we be able, you know, to count the cost? Will we be able to say thank you, God? Will we be able, you know, to have another day, or more or less to pray and to fellowship?
Well, Reverend Walker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
God bless and keep you.
Reverend Willie Walker is the pastor of Noah's Ark Ministries in New Orleans. We continue our observation of this National Day of Prayer and Remembrance in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ooh, when the saints go marching in. Counted in that glory number. Oh, yes, I do.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of portable professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of the works of Tom Robbins, including his new hardcover, Wild Ducks Flying Backward, The Short Writings of Tom Robbins. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with a cop who rescued inmates in a flooded prison and a priest who was evacuated to the Superdome. Novelist Alice Sebold reflects on living with the dead, and Gregory Davis of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band talks about playing jazz funerals. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is a National Day of Prayer and Remembrance for the victims of Hurricane Katrina. Our next guest spent 8 days rescuing people from the flood. Lieutenant Kevin Judice works on the narcotics squad in New Iberia, which is about 100 miles away from New Orleans. He's been on the force for 10 years and served 6 years in the National Guard. Since New Iberia had no significant hurricane damage, a group from his police department was able to go to New Orleans. One of the things you did was evacuate critically ill patients from Charity Hospital. Would you describe what you saw when you got there and tell us what it was like to to evacuate the patients?
Sure. It Charity Hospital is it's about 12 or 13 stories tall. We had to get to the top on the outside fire escape. Got to the top, made contact with the people up there, told them what we were there to do. They began preparing the people who had to leave right now. And that's what they did. They put them on backboards, secured them as best they could, and we carried them down, back down those 12 floors while they continued to work on them, continued to breathe for these people and things like that, and loaded them on boats, let the medical personnel on the boats, and brought them to the Superdome, which was not far away, where they were still at the time airlifting people from those ramps on the dome by helicopter to Baton Rouge, and we did that until we couldn't do it anymore. We really became physically exhausted. We just couldn't climb anymore, couldn't carry anymore. And at that time, it was getting it was dark, and the people we had left behind at the to guard everything were really becoming concerned about being able to exit safely.
Mm-hmm.
So we made one last trip to charity. We actually stopped. We picked up some children. They were floating in a plastic pool, and picked them up, got them to the dome as well. And then we loaded the boats and went back to our command post.
You helped evacuate a prison?
Correct.
How did the prisoners respond to you? Did any of them, did they try to escape?
No, I don't know if any did actually escape, but no, I mean, there was not a single problem at all. I mean, it was so happy to see somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter if it was law enforcement or anyone, that they'd have gone with anybody at that point because they had nothing. I mean, they were locked into in a prison that they couldn't get out of, and it was flooded. It was underwater. And they were hanging signs from the windows, help, on and on and on. And we actually became, when we got there, when the prison officials saw us in the water, they asked if we could help. I mean, so, there were thousands. You're talking about 7,000 to 8,000 prisoners in this prison.
So where did you take the ones that you rescued? Where did you take them to?
Prison buses were there to take them out, to take them to Louisiana State Penitentiary or to various other correctional institutes, I mean, as they could get them. I mean, there were thousands that were just sitting on various overpasses. I mean, they were in bad shape. I'll tell you, I really felt for these guys because they were. I mean, I lost count of how many passed out. You know, as you're trying to, you bring them. And that day we were really in the water, and it was really getting bad. And you know, because we'd get them to a certain point where the boats could no longer get through. It was debris. It was railroad tracks, that kind of a thing. We'd have to get them in the water and actually walk them, you know, along a path that we had established was safe in the water, get them into an area, line them up until other buses could get there. And it took hours. I think we got about 3,000 out that day. And they brought water. They brought food. And, I mean, these guys hadn't eaten in 2 days. So, I mean, they were appreciative. And there's no doubt. I mean, they were extremely appreciative.
Do you feel like you were... How do you feel like you were changed by this experience?
I'll tell you, it's hard to say. I mean, it has really shown you your humanity. I can say that, you know. When I got down there, it made me feel very, very small, that you were in the middle of a very big problem, and that, I mean, you know, we all tend to think of ourselves as the center of the universe sometimes, but it's really made me, realize that we're not. We're part of a larger community. We have to think that way. If we don't think that way, this is what happens. You know, I appreciate I always have. I've always been a very, big family person. It's the most important thing in my life. And but I mean, after 8 days there and seeing my children, which I have three, and my wife again, it was a sobering experience. You know, it made me just realize that I had something to come back to. You know, at any given time, I could turn the car around, tell them I've had enough, and I could drive home and stay there. Whereas, you know, these people couldn't.
Do you think of your job as a cop any differently now than you did before Katrina?
I'll tell you, it's been hard to get back into cop mode, if I can say it that way, into the law enforcement type mode, into going out and, you know, I've had meetings with various citizens about different things, you know, about complaints in the areas, about, you know, there's loud music here, and, you know, there's people hanging out late at night here, and it's, you know, I had to sit through that and keep reminding myself that, you know, these are problems to these people, and just, and not think that, you know, you really have no problems. You know, in the general scope of things, this is not a big problem for you. You know, if you could have seen what I saw and been where I've been, then you'd understand that, you know, loud music late at night is not really that big of a deal. That we're going to get to it and that we'll take care of it. But, you know, let's just remember what's happening down there even as we speak.
Let me just ask you one more thing before we wrap up. I know you were traveling through the stench of the waters in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Have you gotten the smell out of your nose yet?
It took a while. It really did. I mean, that's the biggest thing, was that smell. It was this, and it's not just that that sewer smell. It was gasoline. I mean, it hit me in a big way a couple of days ago when I was putting gas in my police unit. That smell that reminds me so much of being down there. I mean, you could see it on the water, just gasoline and diesel and other chemicals, just a film on the water everywhere you went. There was, I mean, hundreds of cars submerged. Some of them you could see, some of them you couldn't. And that smell mixed with that. With that sewer smell was overpowering, and any equipment we had that was in that water is gone. We've thrown it all away, and we're ordering brand new stuff. It's just it's unusable. It's contaminated, but that gasoline smell is something that sticks with me.
Thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you the best.
Absolutely, it's good talking to you too.
Lieutenant Kevin Judice spoke to us from New Iberia, where he works on the police department's narcotics division. Coming up, a priest who was evacuated to the Superdome. This is Fresh Air. Father Anthony DeConcilies moved to New Orleans in August to start his new position as president of the Community College Our Lady of Holy Cross, which was founded with the mission of helping the poor. He was inaugurated August 26th. 3 days later, when the hurricane struck, he stayed at the school where he felt he belonged. As the waters rose, he knew he had to get out. He was rescued Wednesday and evacuated to the Superdome, where he stayed until Thursday afternoon. We called him in New York and asked what he observed at the Superdome.
When you first entered, everyone, of course, was concerned about their homes, and many people were trying to take with them their belongings, little pieces of material, it looked like, or trinkets or toys, and guarding them in a sense of holding them to their hearts. And that gave you a sense of the fear and the trepidation of the people there. Of course, many of the people there did not have a lot of possessions in any case, I would imagine. And when you got through the line to be searched for weapons and other articles that may hurt somebody else, you had a sense that you were moving into an atmosphere, an environment that was safe but cautious and unsafe. And it was a sense of being locked in almost, because when you went in, you knew that you weren't going to get out easily out of that building.
What were your prayers like then? I mean, I don't want to invade your privacy here, but I'm wondering, like, in a time of crisis like that, when you were in the Superdome, Were your prayers more a kind of meditative kind of prayer, or more of a sense of like trying to directly communicate, asking for something? I mean, what was the nature of your prayer?
The nature of my prayer was to engender courage and fortitude and a sensitivity for other people, and not to reflect so much on what was happening to me. And so I asked God to help me to move out to others, and in that way keep me clearer on the needs of others than my own needs.
You said that you prayed for courage. Were you afraid in the Superdome? It sounds like there'd be plenty of things to be afraid of.
Certainly. I think anyone who was not concerned was not seeing the reality of the situation.
What did you do to pass the time? I mean, I imagine it was pretty dark, even in the daytime.
Well, there was enough light that you could read, and I had a Bible with me, and so I read.
You read the Bible?
Yes.
What did you read? Which parts?
Oh, I read St. John, and I read those areas where of St. Paul where he talks about courage. And
why St. John?
Oh, it's my favorite, one of my favorite Gospels.
Why?
Because St. John is a Gospel of love, a Gospel where he shows a tremendous affection of God for his people, and is not as factual as the other synoptics, but his gospel really shows how much the affection God had for his people, and that always has impressed me over the years.
Times of crisis and catastrophe tend to test people's faith. I mean, some people lose their faith, some people find faith they never had before, and I'm wondering if there was any point where you felt like your faith was shaken, or if people you know had their faith shaken.
Well, I can't answer for other people, but for me, it was like a second wind. We always talk about the Holy Spirit coming into, breathing into life into the disciples in the upper room. In a way, I feel that happened to me. I can't express it yet, and I'm going to be writing about it, certainly. But it was a new breath, a new way of looking at life and faith for me, rather than a challenge to my faith at all.
In what sense was it a new way of looking at life?
Well, as you can imagine, most of the people in the dome were people from the city of New Orleans. And given that so many had so little, I looked at that and I said to myself, this is where my college is and where we are living, and how can we serve more and more of these people in our college, and indeed all the colleges, because it is education that helps so many people move from one step to the other.
Father Anthony DeConcilies is the new president of Our Lady of Holy Cross College in New Orleans. The college is now being used by police and reservists from New York. This day of remembrance for the victims of Katrina comes less than a week after the fourth anniversary of the September 11th attacks. My guest, Alice Siebold, wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times reflecting on both catastrophic events, titled Living with the Dead. Siebold is the author of the best-selling novel, The Lovely Bones, which was written from the point of view of a 14-year-old girl who was raped and murdered and is now in heaven, watching her family and friends carry on without her. We invited Siebold to read an excerpt of her op-ed piece, Living with the Dead.
What can the living do in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and 9/11, where loss has greeted us twice on a national scale in such a short span of years? Do the dead wish you to suffer? Do they want you to watch CNN and Fox News for days on end? Do they want your guilt or pity? All of these things are like jewels to them. In other words, valueless where they have gone. Instead, a woman wants her husband not to forget her, but to go on and live. A child longs for a lost mother's arms again. A man grows peaceful when his partner finds new love. Some of the dead, I imagine, get enraged at these things. They are dead after all. They get to do and feel, I hope, what they want to. The living, who are close to the dead, have a well-marked path of grief to walk down. But what about the rest of us? What can we, the distant, those of us who live in Nebraska or California or the very tip of Maine, do? You are in your kitchen or your backyard or stuck on an endless elevator ride. You are sitting with a book in the park. Perhaps it is an image you remember having seen, a handmade grave of sheets and bricks. Here lies Vera, God help us. Perhaps it is the voice from a message left on an answering machine. They have told us to remain at our desks. I'm okay, Mom. I love you. Perhaps it is less specific. Bodies falling from high windows, bodies floating in muddy water, bodies wrapped in dirty bedding and tucked along the sides of bridges and highways, the faces of the missing taped and tacked up on a wall. Whatever it is that comes to you in 3 months, 6 months, a year or more, don't turn the page of your book and forget. Don't stab the elevator button, trying to hurry up the trip. Stop. These tragedies, it's worth remembering, grant us an opportunity to understand what is perhaps our finest raw material, our humanity, the way we at our best treat one another, the way we listen to one another, the way we grieve.
Ella Siebold, thanks for reading that. Why did you decide to write this piece?
I think I was overwhelmed, as almost all of us were, by the images coming out of New Orleans and how helpless almost all of us were, those who were there and those far away. And in that helplessness, I just kept seeing the people who were dying or who were at that grave that I speak of in the in that passage, Here Lies Vera, God Help Us. That was an image that had a lot of impact on me because it was a pretty early image, and it was a beautiful grave, and it was out of sheets and rocks, and it talked about, even in the midst of all that helplessness, the attention that was given to that dead body, and it touched me a lot. And I think out of those images, I just felt like I wanted to go to some kind of prayer. In some sense, the piece that I wrote is some type of prayer for me in that way, to acknowledge the dead and to hope to have communion between the living and the dead.
You know, your piece is about the importance of keeping the dead in our memory, and that's what this day is about. Why does it feel so important to you? And we're talking here of dead people that you don't know. Where do you live?
I live in California.
Right. So you're at a remove.
Right.
So how does one keep alive the memory of the dead that you don't even know?
Well, I think, you know, the honest answer to that is you will never know the specific facts of these people's lives. So you can't grieve them or honor them in the same way of those people that did know them. Perhaps part of it is because I naturally go toward narrative, but you know, you honor them by thinking of them, by remembering the images that you might not wish to remember, that might be difficult to think about, and by imagining them struggling for life and acknowledging that you could be in that very position yourself. So it's a certain sense of putting yourself in the position of the person who has died and honoring them in that moment.
And you think that just like thinking about the dead is a potent way of doing that? It doesn't have to be a more formal kind of prayer.
That is what I do, because I like I said, I'm not somebody who prays in a formal way. I think that it you have to be very aware of what you're doing, and you're doing it for them and for yourself simultaneously. I think it can be very potent, and I think sometimes what's dangerous about a more formalized prayer is that you end up saying words that you're not connecting with necessarily. You're doing it because, oh, well, this is the time to pray. We pray now, and then tomorrow I go and buy an SUV. And my sense is that, no, make it fluid, make it, in some sense, whenever it comes to you, as opposed to a specific time. You know, I would hope that one doesn't have to be efficient about grief, and that it can be spread across whatever days that the images come back to you. This is something that's going to be, you know, in our newspapers and on our television for a very long time. And the idea that it only exists when the TV is on, or it only exists one day of the week, I think is a foolish belief.
On this day of remembrance, what do you think is the power of keeping people in our memories?
First of all, I think part of it is just it comes down to how you want to live. And so you are making a conscious choice to keep them in your memory. For me, I will say in a very selfish, it's a selfish choice for me to think that the dead are somehow present in life. It's a form of playing with the world in some sense and inviting the dead to play with you instead of sealing them off forever as separate from us. I think that that's what I just instinctually feel doesn't make sense, is that when people die, they're gone physically, but they're everywhere simultaneously, I think.
Alice Siebold, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Siebold's article, Living with the Dead, was published last Sunday in the New York Times. Coming up, Gregory Davis of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. He's played hundreds of New Orleans jazz funerals. This is Fresh Air. On this day of remembrance, we close with trumpeter Gregory Davis, a New Orleans musician who has played at hundreds of jazz funerals. His internationally known group, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, even has an album called Funeral for a Friend. Trumpeter Gregory Davis and his family evacuated to Houston. We called him there. I think at funerals, mournful music is played on the way to the grave and then more joyful music on the way back. Is that right?
That's right. On the way out of the church and to the cemetery, you know, it's sad, mournful music because, you know, you do want to honor and respect, you know, the funeral itself and the death of the, you know, the person that you're honoring. But once, you know, that body, it used to be, but, you know, now you, because you can't get to the funeral, I'm sorry, to the cemetery all the time, once that body was put into the grave, the party started, you know, back to this person's home or back to his favorite, you know, spot, wherever he used to like to hang out. And that just symbolizes, you know, yeah, death is sad and it hurts. But life goes on, you know, and it's a joy to be alive. And the music, it's reflected in the music.
Today is a national day of prayer and remembrance for the people who died in the hurricane. And I'm wondering, like, we want to end our show with some music, and we thought some music that is often played at New Orleans funerals might be appropriate. Is there a song that's particularly going through your mind today?
A song that's going through my mind? When I first saw the devastation, you know, I did think of, you know, the song I'll Fly Away, you know, the lyrics dealing with some glad morning when this life is over, you know, I'll fly away. You know, I'm struggling here on earth, but one day it's all going to be over, you know, and I'll fly away to glory. We lost... You know, we don't know how many people we actually lost. They're still finding, you know, bodies in some of the houses. Some people were trapped in attics and on rooftops. And, you know, there were people dying in nursing homes that they had no way out, you know. So for me, I don't know what I'm going back to, but I know some of the happy faces that I used to see around New Orleans, you know, I won't see them anymore. Some of the watering holes and some of the spots where we used to play and, you know, where we rehearsed and where we grew up, some of those places are not going to be there anymore. You know, we have them in our memories, but physically, you know, we can't pass them on, you know, to our siblings, to our children. But, you know, we're coming back.
So you're confident you're going to go back to New Orleans?
Oh, I know I'm going back. I have no doubt in my mind that no matter what it takes, you know, if my home is destroyed, if it has to be torn down and start over, I have to start over. You know, I'm going back. I've been blessed. I've traveled all over this world, and there's no other place in this world that I would rather live than New Orleans.
Gregory, thank you. Thank you very much, and I wish good luck to you and your family.
Thank you very much.
Gregory Davis plays trumpet with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. We thank all our guests for helping us observe this day of remembrance for the victims of Katrina. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Joan Tui Westman, and Mike and Scott. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. And from the Wall Street Journal, introducing the new Saturday Weekend Edition, designed to inspire when it's time to unwind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Five Families, the Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. Former New York Times crime reporter Selwyn Rabb tells us how organized crime in New York City was revitalized in the aftermath of September 11th. Join us for the next Fresh Air.